Hello, this is Terrence McNally, and this week you'll hear my July 2006 conversation with Alvin Toffler, best-selling author of Future Shock and the Third Wave, about his book Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. It's been 10 years now. How well could he see the future? Who will get tomorrow's wealth? How will it be made? What will it mean for all of us? These are big, important questions, but who could we possibly turn to for the answers? Well, today I'm going to talk about them with someone who has shown a willingness and an ability to think and talk about the future and such big questions on a national and international stage for over three decades. I, like most people, first heard of today's guest, Alvin Toffler, in 1972 when a book title introduced us to a new idea that may have evolved over the years, but has never really left us, Future Shock. He and his wife Heidi followed that book about a decade later with The Third Wave, and about a decade after that with Power Shift. In their newest book, Revolutionary Wealth, Alvin and Heidi Toffler discuss an economic revolution sweeping the globe and the impact it will have in every area of our lives. 21st century wealth, according to the Tofflers, is not just about money and cannot be understood in terms of industrial age economics. They describe in the book how our society is being transformed in ways still unnoticed or unaccounted for, and offer practical ideas about how we can prepare for what they call the most massive, most creative, and fastest expansion of the money economy in human history. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Alvin Toffler is highly regarded worldwide by business and political leaders for his vision. He's been a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation, a visiting professor at Cornell University, a faculty member at the New School for Social Research, a White House correspondent, an editor at Fortune magazine, and a business consultant in addition to all the work as an author. Welcome, Alvin Toffler, finally, to Free Forum.
It's been a long time.
So I like listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas. And though you're someone who's made a career of thinking and writing about the future, you spent some of your earlier years toiling in the trenches of social change, didn't you?
Absolutely, and learned a lot from it. My wife and I, after we left university, decided we wanted to help the trade union movement. And we got ourselves jobs on the assembly line and worked for 5 years in factories of one kind or another. Turning out, I did everything from work on automobiles to window fans to bicycles, all on assembly lines, and then became what in factories used to be called a millwright, that is a mechanic fixing some of the gear and so forth and so on. So that was an introduction to the real life in industrial societies, in industrial age economies.
Okay. And you did that why?
I did that because we came out of World War II strongly motivated to support what we regarded as democracy, and that included race relations. We felt that we were against any kind of race discrimination. And that was part of our agenda, going and working there. And then in 1948, I had the good fortune to go to the South and spend some time, not a lot, but some time, registering black voters for the 1948 election. That was a year when most people now forget there were four political parties running. There were the Democrats, there were the Republicans, there were the Progressives, and there were the Dixiecrats, the segregationists. And so I went down and spent some weeks with some black friends traveling around and registering black voters. And then, however, came back to home base, which was New York, and on the assumption that any ordinary 19-year-old would do. I've got dirty clothes. I'll take them home for mom to wash. And I go back down after the weekend. But what happened is I got sidetracked. I went to NYU to see if any of my pals were around. And I found a pal sitting on a bench. And next to her was this beautiful blonde. And that's Heidi. And we've been together ever since.
You know, as we spoke before we went on the air, I first heard you speak when we're talking about Future Shock in 1972. I remember I interviewed you for a documentary in 92. And it was clear to me all those years that you and Heidi were a team. And yet her name has only been on one or two of the books, right?
That was by her insistence. For years, I couldn't get her to put her name on. She finally came around, and the New York Times interviewed her and said, "Why did you change?" And she said, "Oh, what the hell?" And they printed that.
As they finally just added the Bush bleeped word to their audio file of his little conversation with Blair. Okay, so we've established sort of where you were before, toiling for voter rights, racial rights, labor, and so on. And how did the transformation come to writing about the future?
Well, there was no question in my mind as to what I wanted to do. From the time I was 7 years old, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I had an uncle and aunt who were role models, Depression-era intellectuals, and they encouraged this. And I still have the first thesaurus I ever saw handed to me by my aunt when I was 14 years old. I knew I wanted to write. And I also knew that if you wanted to write, you needed to have some experience other than just growing up in a happy household. And my models were very simple. Jack London became a sailor. Steinbeck picked grapes. You had to do something. And so that was the underlying
number. So even as you were doing those other things, you knew what the future was.
Yeah. I knew that part of the future.
Part,
I was hoping that
part.
Would be – hoping that would be the part of the future.
And you then worked for Fortune magazine?
Well, what happened after that is I worked for a labor paper, actually. There was in the United States for some time a daily newspaper published by the trade unions. It was published by the printers union, the ITU. And they hired me because I had actual experience. And I worked for them as a journalist for a few years. I covered the Democratic Party convention. I covered farmers' revolt in the Midwest and a variety of other stories. And then had the incredible good fortune of being sent by them jointly with a Pennsylvania commercial daily to Washington and spent 3 years in the covering Congress and the White House. So I went from the bottom to the top, so to speak, in the society.
And yet with the transition being labor.
And in that case, the transition point was, in fact, the connection with the labor movement. Then, as I say, I left Washington after 10 years away from New York and went back to New York, and Fortune magazine asked me to join them, and I did. And I then had I'd had exposure to labor. I'd had exposure to work in the factories. I'd had several years of exposure to politics at the top level, but I had no contact or knowledge about business. And Fortune gave me that opportunity.
So you went right in and were writing about business?
I went in first to do the labor column.
Figures.
For just a couple of months. I said I didn't want to do that anymore because I'd covered that. And eventually wound up writing stories about businesses, and that was very good. I learned a lot.
And I've actually heard you speak about this before, but to some today it would seem odd that someone who was apparently as progressive as yourself with little experience about business would be hired by Fortune. And I've heard you said that you weren't the only one.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. Fortune reached out, and they had quite a stellar past of writers who became famous at one point or another. Also, you know those wonderful, fantastic photos of the Depression era people in Tennessee and so forth?
The Walker Evans.
Walker
kind of
Evans.
Things,
That was Fortune. Fortune did all kinds of interesting stuff and quite literary stuff at the time as well. But the other thing that I left Fortune after a couple of years and had the amazing experience then of being asked, believe it or not, by IBM to write a paper in 1962 on the social and organizational implications of the computer. And that took me for the first time to high technology. And I came out to California for the first time. I met the people creating the first random access machines, and I met the earliest artificial intelligencers, and had a little immersion in technology. So I had gone through all these three different, very different parts of America, so to speak.
It's interesting that, as I heard you say it, the way you said it even, you can tell that was one of those turning points where whatever was going to come next, it seems to me, shaped the direction.
Well, we also made our living hand-to-mouth by writing, by being freelance writers, and we wrote articles for every magazine under the sun, from political magazines like The Nation and The Progressive to Ladies' Home Journal too, Good Housekeeping, Playboy, Red Book, all of those popular magazines. And we wrote on every subject under the sun, from health.
Yeah, did you interview Nabokov
yes,
for Playboy?
Yes,
I mean, that's
yes.
There you could win a trivia contest.
Indeed, we did. Heidi and I spent 10 days holed up in a hotel in Switzerland with Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita and wrote many, many wonderful books after that.
Wow. Let's move up to Future Shock. How did that book happen? First of all, how did it happen? How did you say, because at that point you hadn't written a book yet, yes?
No.
So the two...
Oh, no, excuse me, I had, yes. There's an earlier book that we wrote right after leaving Fortune. It was called The Culture Consumers, and it was about the economics of the arts in the United States. Again, a topic nobody had addressed. And so we had this incredible range of diverse exposures. And Future Shock happened as a result of a magazine article. We wrote an article... it's a funny story. Another journalist who had just left Fortune about the same time we did said he's working for a magazine called Horizon and Heritage. There were two magazines in the same shop, Heritage and Horizon. And would I do a piece for Horizon? And I said only if I could do a profile of an economist called Kenneth Boulding. He had been the head of the American Economics Association, but he was one of these wide-ranging guys who wrote about everything and wonderful, brilliant, brilliant man.
Systems theory.
Systems theory and conflict resolution, mm-hmm. all kinds of topics beyond the normal range of economists. And so I said, I want to do a profile of him. He said, okay. So I went off to Ann Arbor to spend a day or two with him and his wife and came back and was about to write the lead when the phone rang. This was a special magazine. I've neglected to tell you. It was going to be distributed on airplanes. Nobody had ever done that before. It was a magazine to be called Sky.
What a wacky idea.
Yeah. And then what happened was I sat down ready to write when I got a call from my buddy who was working over there. He said, stop. The sky has fallen in. It will not appear. And he said, but why don't you write a piece for one of our magazines? Why don't you write a piece about the future? Because I was interviewing Boulding about the future. And that led to the introduction of the term Future Shock, the concept that if you could be befuddled by a strange culture, by sudden entry into a strange culture where you're getting all kinds of cues that you don't understand, why would you not suffer the same consequences if a strange culture came to you? And that was the basis of Future Shock. We argued that a strange culture was indeed about to come to us.
And to remind people, again, that's 1972, so we're talking 34 years ago, and you're writing it. 72, 34 years ago, and you're writing it even before that, say about 1970. What were the big ideas besides that one, that a culture, the future, was rapidly invading our lives?
Well, acceleration of change. It wasn't just that we're being confronted with new things, but they were coming at us faster. And we then discussed what are the social consequences of that. And for example, it meant that all kinds of formerly stable, long-lasting relationships became short-lasting. Well, that has an impact on family structure. That has an impact on divorce. It has an impact on friendship. It has an impact on economics. It has an impact on how long contracts are written for, and so on. So we talked about transience, the coming age of transience in America. Everything's short-lived, move on. And then that was true not just for social arrangements, but it was true of information. Information became obsolete more often, more quickly. It was true of organizational structures inside companies, for example. You might work with this group, but pretty soon you have to break up this group and reorganize and work with another group.
And as you're saying these things to anyone who, you know, let's say someone is 30 or 40, you know, these things you're mentioning are, you know, they're like fish in water,
exactly.
Right? That's just the way the world is.
Yeah.
How radical was it when you were pointing out these things at that point?
Well, I don't know that it was radical in a political sense, but it was radical in a social sense. I remember doing a radio interview when Future Shock came out, and we talked about the impact of all of this, say, on family life and divorce and so forth, and a whole lot of other personal things. And I remember the interviewer saying, "This book justifies my hang-ups."
It tells me
I'm not crazy. I'm not alone. Everybody else is feeling this too. Something's happening here.
Yeah, which I think when you put it that way, when you put it down to the single person going, "Oh, it's not just me that's having trouble coping with all this."
Right.
That really was probably the biggest impact of that book.
Well, it had a lot of other impacts as well. If you get right down to it, Ted Turner has often said it led him to create CNN, and there are many companies that started up in the wake of Future Shock, and then of course that was just the beginning of our career. We started writing other stuff,
right?
But it had an incredible impact around the world. I mean, it was broadcast into the Amazon jungles by a Catholic ministry. It turned up on the tundra, and we had the experience in Hokkaido in northern Japan, where we were doing a little television documentary based on it. Seeing a line of Western hippies come down the mountainside waving copies of Future Shock,
oh
like
God.
The little red book, you know?
Oh, my God. Now, so that's Future Shock, and that now sets up that you guys have sort of carved out a bit of territory. Now, as I said in the introduction, there's been a book sort of each decade since then. So it looks to me like some of the ideas, some of the principles, some of the terrain you're looking at goes through each book, and it's you sort of saying, okay, now what's happened and what's new and where are we going now? Can you sort of trace that evolution of some of the biggest ideas? And before you do, let me remind people that you're listening to Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Alvin Toffler, best-selling author with his wife Heidi of Future Shock, The Third Wave, Power Shift, and their newest is Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. And you can learn more about all of this at www.alvintoffler.net, Alvin Toffler, one word, .net. So the evolution of the ideas first brought forth in Future Shock to Revolutionary Wealth.
Well, the next one of our big books was The Third Wave. And in The Third Wave, we went back into history and tried to put this sudden rash of accelerated change into a historical perspective. And we introduced the terms first wave, second wave, third wave. That the first great wave of change was the shift from hunting and gathering to an agrarian world. Not, I wouldn't say just economy, but an agrarian world around the world. People were peasants. That was what you did. And then the second wave of change came with the Industrial Revolution. And we argued then, and this was 1980, that we were now going to feel the impact of a third great wave of change on a scale similar or greater than the Industrial Revolution, and that was partly related to the new technologies that were coming down the line and so forth. And that would have, again, an impact on every social relationship as well as on global politics and everything else.
And the impacts, if you can – again, so we can – form the foundation for Revolutionary Wealth, the impacts of this third wave, which had a lot to do with information technologies, had a lot to do with, I would imagine, globalization and the things that now are called flattening and all those things. Mm-hmm. What were I mean, I've sort of said them, but what were those biggest notions? And then we can see how they've evolved over the last 25 years, really.
Well, two things happened. Let's put it this way. I'll tell two stories.
Great.
Two things happened in the wake of the publication of The Third Wave. One was in China. We were invited. We'd never wanted to go to China in a tour group or, you know, or we waited until it was possible to go as individuals.
Mm.
We were invited by something called the Chinese Society for Future Studies when it was first set up, and they were part of the Chinese Academy of Social Science. And we said, if you were really a Marxist, as who knows we'd been.
So you knew what you were talking about.
And you know who knows. then you knew the future. You knew the social, economic, political structure of change, and you knew where you were going. If the Chinese had allowed someone to set up a futures group to study the future, that we took to be a signal. And so we went to the Chinese – it was a part of the Chinese Academy
of Social
Science.
Let me see if I follow that. If you're setting up something to study the future, then you're maybe not so certain of what's being determined by Marxism.
Yeah.
And there are new questions that have emerged.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what happens is we go there and we're invited to lecture in Shanghai and Beijing and Suzhou. And by that time, we'd shot a 90-minute I think quite beautiful documentary based on the Third Wave, which Heidi basically produced with the help of NHK TV in Japan and TV Ontario in Canada. Anyway, so we delivered to them a copy of this audio tape, and I said, Heidi, what'd you take it for? They won't show it. And she said, don't be stupid. They'll see it at the top. And what happens is we lecture and we go home. We know nothing about it. 2 years later, we're flying to Paris for a conference, and I'm reading L'Express, a French magazine, and it says the best-selling book in China after the speeches of Deng Xiaoping is The Third Wave by Alvin Toffler. And we're blown out of our seats. How did that happen? We didn't know. Well, why?
Yeah, one speech doesn't do that.
Yeah. So we then were visited by the scholar who had been our handler in China. And he came to New York, and he said, well, here's what happened. After you left, the Third Wave was published in about 3,000 copies just for senior officials. And then it was attacked immediately as Western spiritual pollution. And it was withdrawn even from the leadership, but for the top. And then he said they broke out a battle inside the Politburo about the book. And that went on for about 6 months. And then in October of 1983, the then prime minister, who was Zhou Ziyang, the guy who defended the students during the Tiananmen Square thing, Zhou Ziyang was prime minister then, and he said, we should study the Third Wave. And people were still afraid. So they then went to the then chairman of the party, who was the only higher official, and said, what do you think? And he said, too many people are afraid of new ideas. Too many people in the party are afraid of new ideas. And that led to an explosion. It was published in every conceivable regional edition, classroom editions. It was a weapon for the reformers to change China.
Now, it occurs to me that at this moment,
this was 1983.
83. China actually at that moment exists in all three waves, doesn't it?
It had not yet.
Well,
really,
not yet
it had
in
the third wave.
But it had the agrarian.
Exactly. Exactly.
Millions.
And still does. It has 800-900 million peasants. And China is remarkable today. It's one of the relatively few countries that does have all three waves of change going through it at the same time. Well, how do you manage a society?
And individuals,
like that?
I would imagine, go through all three in their lifetime.
Right. The peasant goes to the city, maybe moves on, or the next generation, the kid moves on. So you have the grandparents are peasants, the father and mother are working in factories, and the kid is carrying electronic equipment.
Yeah, and I can imagine also because all three exist and the preponderance of people are still in wave one, that it would be both inviting and threatening.
Yeah, it is.
Unlike it might be here. Yeah.
Well, in fact, I think that wherever you have a new wave of change of this magnitude emerges, you have conflict between those who have vested interests, whether they're political interests or economic interests in preserving the past. And so you have conflict between what we call wave conflict in societies. And I think that a lot of what passes for other kinds of conflict.
Religious philosophical.
Conflict, exactly. And in countries where they fight and kill each other. A clue to reading the press for me is watch for the words urban and rural. Because if underneath the political battles – whether it's in Japan where they want to privatize the postal bank, and there's a big fight in Japan about this. Who's on which side? And you notice that it's a direct battle between urban and rural populations. And increasingly now, third wave populations have their own interests.
Okay. It's one of the things you do in your books, but it's one of the things I really appreciate here is I ask you an idea question, you give me a story answer. And I really appreciate that. The second story you're going to tell, and we've got about 2 more minutes.
The second story was another strange adventure we had, along with a group of other Americans and foreigners. About a dozen of us were invited to the Soviet Union in 1986, 3 years after all of that happened, and we held a conference, and none of us could really and the participants were Arthur Miller. And a whole raft of famous people from the arts. And we were there for a week. And we didn't know what we were doing. What we would do, and then they said, we want you to sign a manifesto. It says, the 21st century is coming. Intellectuals are going to need to prepare people for it.
And this is the Gorbachev era, the perestroika, the
right,
birth
just
sort of
the very beginnings, right. And we say, well, we weren't going to sign anti-new, anti-American stuff, but we can all sign futures coming. We should help prepare people. That's great, right? But I thought we should add one sentence, and that is, and therefore should be free to express our views without fear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I waited for the response. And the response was, great idea! At which point, everybody signs, and we're immediately taken to meet Gorbachev. And the story there, it's a long, more complicated story, but that was the creation of the first NGO.
The first nonprofit.
The first nonprofit, non-business, non-party, Communist Party, non-state organization in the Soviet Union since 1917.
Okay. I'm sorry we had to do that one so small, but we're just dealing with the impacts of the third wave in the early 80s. So again, the new book, which we will talk about in part two, is Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. The website is www.alvintoffler, one word, alvintoffler.net. Remember, that's .net.
This is Terrence McNally, and you're listening to my July 2006 conversation with Alvin Toffler about his book, Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives.
This is part two of a two-part interview with Alvin Toffler. In 1972, he and his wife Heidi put out a book called Future Shock, which really, I think, is one of those books, you know, there's a few of them that you can find on your shelves, that really said something to society and change the way society thought about itself. And I actually had the good fortune to meet Alvin Toffler after a talk he gave. I was visiting my family in Atlanta and at Georgia State University afterwards, and I said, this stuff interests me. Here we are 34 years later sitting in a radio studio, and this stuff still interests me. In their newest book, Revolutionary Wealth, Alvin and Heidi discuss an economic revolution sweeping the globe and the impact they feel it will have in every area of our lives. 21st century wealth, according to them, is not just about money and can't be understood in the same terms as industrial age economics. They describe how our society is being transformed in ways still unnoticed or unaccounted for, and they offer practical ideas about how we can prepare for what they say will be the most massive, most creative and fastest expansion of the money economy in human history. I want to bring people who might have missed part one up to speed a little bit. So before jumping into Revolutionary Wealth, which is where we'll spend most of our time, just if you could recap what for you was the big notion of Future Shock and then the big notion of Third Wave, and then we'll go to Revolutionary Wealth.
The big notion of Future Shock was that change was accelerating to a point at which it was making it difficult for people to adapt, and not just people but organizations and governments and so on. That change was moving more and more speedily, more and more rapidly, and that was getting ahead of the capability of individuals and organizations to keep up unless they really understood what was going on.
Okay. And then third wave.
In the third wave, I think the central point is in the title. And that is that history can be seen in terms of gigantic waves of change that moved across the world. The first was the shift from hunting and gathering to agriculture, that we call the first wave of change. The second was the shift from agriculture to an industrial smokestack kind of economy. That was the second wave. And we argued in the third wave that we were now moving toward a knowledge-based economy, which was radically different from anything that had previously existed, and that it was part of a gigantic third wave of change in history. And within that framework, we talked about, again, as we did in Future Shock and in all of our work, we talk about we try not to separate economics from social, cultural, political, artistic contacts. All of these things are interrelated. And so the book, all of our books deal across the board with many, many different topics, but they have these large themes.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it seems to me that the two that sort of start at the core are the relationship of technology and economics, and then it's how everything else relates to that.
But everything else changes technology just as technology changes everything else. The thing is that we are terrifically good at technology, and it changes very, very rapidly now. It wasn't always the case. But the hard part is changing social structures. It's not easy, but it's easier to make a diagram and change a piece of machinery than to get everybody to agree to change the structure of a government or an economy.
Yeah, I'm thinking, actually, I interviewed Jared Diamond about his book Collapse, and he talks about those societies that succeed and those that have collapsed. And he says the two biggest things are when a society can't let go of old values in the face of new evidence.
Mm-hmm. That certainly seems like a reasonable part of the problem. We need to know what we don't know. And there's a lot that we don't know. So we can't pretend to be, you know, that. And nothing applies universally because there are differences between cultures and people and so forth and so on. But I think across the board, it is very difficult sometimes to get people to change because people, are especially poor people. We usually say it's the rich. It's the poor now because they have more at risk. What little they have is at risk.
That's right. They don't have a margin for error.
They can't fail. They can't fail. And when we come in and say, do this or do that, and it'll increase your – things will go better, they say, yeah, but what if it doesn't? And so they are glued to the past. But the same thing's true of a lot of, you know, very rich people who have investments in yesterday's technologies and don't want to see the new ones replace them and so forth and so on. So getting past all of that to bring about some kind of social change is not an easy task, and it's not something that can be done just by, you know, a few people sitting in a little Silicon Valley garage.
Yeah, as you
although the people sitting in little garages in Silicon Valley have in fact changed the world.
That's right.
But it's not the same. Let's put it this way.
Well, yeah. I mean, as you said, it's easier to design and create something new. And if it works, it may well get adopted as a technology.
And then people, users, find new ways to use the technology, to turn it into something different than even the originators intended. And I think that this process is now going wild. I mean, it's really
but it's hard. The social web in which that takes place
that's hard to change.
Yeah.
And one of the things we say in our new book, Revolutionary Wealth, is the better a country has adapted its economy to an economic environment and the more integrated the parts of the economy are to one another, the harder it is to change because you can't change one piece without requiring changes in a bunch of other institutions. Well, that's hard. Eventually, we argue in the case of Japan that Japan did so well in the last part of the since roughly the 70s, late 60s, 70s, has done so well, and the structure of family life, the structure of jobs, the lifetime job system, the way corporations interrelated with the government, all of these things were beautifully integrated. They're beautifully integrated and made it difficult for them to change.
That makes very good sense. I was going to refer one other person that I've interviewed recently, Kevin Phillips. He said that the society that dominates one energy era
mm-hmm.
has a very tough time dominating the next one. He points out the Dutch, the wind era, the British, the coal era. And, of course, we have dominated the oil era. And he says that's what – and so it sounds like it's a little bit what you're saying, that the more you – tightly you hold the present.
It's easier to change one thing than to change a whole bunch of things that are interrelated with one another because they have feedback, you know, consequences for each other. And so, in a sense, the better you are. The question, of course, is whether anybody will dominate the next energy wave.
In other words, to some extent, you're saying the next one may not be where anyone dominates.
It may be more flat. I believe we're going to see so many different sources of energy.
And decentralized.
Decentralized increasingly. And I think that there are going to be so many different players and so many different sources that it's not just going to be one big system.
Yeah. Let me tell people you're listening to Free Forum. This is a part two of a two-part interview. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm interviewing Alvin Toffler, best-selling author with his wife Heidi, of Future Shock, The Third Wave. And we're talking, just edging into actually, talking about their newest book, Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created and How It Will Change Our Lives. And you can learn more about Alvin Toffler's thinking and the current book at www.alvintoffler, one word, T-O-F-F-L-E-R, .net, alvintoffler.net. It's so funny, you know, I'm trying to follow a path and yet everything is so interesting. It sounded like, you know, when you said the country that has things most integrated, that is most solidly entrenched, maybe the hardest ones to change, we hear a lot about leapfrogging technology,
mm-hmm.
where a country never puts up the wires to give everyone phone service.
Right.
They just go to cell phones.
Right.
It sounds like what you're saying is that leapfrogging also may be easier in terms of social systems as well.
Well, the United States has legacy institutions. We have yesterday's institutions trying to run tomorrow's economy. And in fact, I believe we're going to see the implosion of many of our major institutions. I call it the institutional Katrinas. And the reason for that is that they were – I mean, we're terrific at designing large-scale bureaucracies. And when we have a problem, we reach for that medicine. And these are no longer appropriate for carrying out the tasks that we give to them in an economy which is increasingly knowledge-based, which no longer runs by the rules of scarcity. Assuming that all resources are scarce, when in fact knowledge is the central resource and it is essentially inexhaustible. I think that we are going into a period in which the desynchronization in our society is going to get us into deep difficulty. By that I mean you have some institutions that change or parts of society that are changing very rapidly and others that are changing very slowly. And the simplest example is business is forced to change rapidly. Business has to change or they competitively die. So let's say they're running down
there is this analogy you use in the book, which is rough ballpark, but you sort of say – let's look at six or seven institutions mm-hmm. and the different speeds at which they're traveling.
Right.
So let's go into that.
So I use the analogy of a cop with a radar gun measuring the speed of cars going by. Each car represents some institution. What's changing fast in our society and what's changing slow? Well, let's take a look. Business is changing very rapidly because it has to, and also because it's closely linked to technology, which is very, very rapidly changing. Next thing that's changing very rapidly, if business is going at 100 miles an hour, we argue that NGOs, which are not regarded as central institutions in this society but are in fact changing at 80 miles an hour, let's say. They're multiplying at an extremely rapid rate, forming networks. They're operating at the local level, at the national level, at the global level. And the change rate within the NGO sector is enormous. The rate of change.
Let me before we get into the rate, why do you think that is?
Oh, I think that's a consequence.
Because in other words, with business, we can sort of see it. Somebody adapts a new technology, you better do it to catch up. What is
NGOs? I think the reason we're seeing an explosion of NGOs reflects two things. It reflects the failure of existing institutions to be able to carry out the tasks that we want them to carry out. And it also represents change because frequently the problems that come with change are not identified or nobody does anything about them because the previous institutions didn't anticipate them. So NGOs crop up to deal with a problem or to call attention to a new problem. There were no arguments about stem cells before stem cells appeared on the scene. Now you've got NGOs fighting the battle on both sides, as a matter of fact. But so what NGOs do is, in a certain sense, either anticipate certain changes before other institutions do. And eventually an NGO may turn into another kind of institution. And who knows, down the line into some enormous bureaucracy as well.
They some of them are old and bureaucratic, but what you're saying is they are gap fillers. They jump into the gap between the established institution and the new issue or the new technology
or something.
If business isn't going to do it because it isn't quite about making a profit –
Or it hasn't got a big enough market to make it work yet, or whatever.
Yeah.
And governments are behind.
Governments are behind. Yeah. So number one, fastest is business. Number two is the civil society or NGOs. Number three is
family. You know, we think historically family life, family structure didn't change for millennia. You know, you had the agrarian family where several generations lived together. Everybody works in the fields, and the family has basic functions in society. It takes care of the elderly because there's no pension system. It educates the kid because there's no school system. It takes care of the ill because there's no medical system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that structure of a large multi-generational family was pretty much widespread throughout the agrarian age of peasant misery. Then came the Industrial Revolution. Well, that brought us specialization, and we got hospitals, and that health goes to the health system.
Schools.
Education goes to the school system, et cetera, et cetera. Family, therefore, loses central functions that it had and loses power vis-a-vis other institutions in the society, which now have clout. And what we wrote in Future Shock in 1970 is that we were going to see a shift from the universal idea of everybody in a nuclear family into a variety of formats. And I think we have done that in the United States, and we're doing it now.
Oh, the statistics when people see them, and you mention them, about, you know, how many single family,
right,
how many unmarried, how many people are alone. It's people do not know this.
We don't, by and large. And at the same time, we now have technologies and changes in the system that are returning functions to the family. So you can work at home now. That changes your relationship. But we're having changes in gender. We're having changes in every aspect of family life, and they're coming rapidly.
And what you're saying is the family, again, is one that's moving pretty quickly.
Yes.
It has to adapt.
It is changing. It is moving. It's among the fastest changing institutions in society. Then you go on and we come down to – so the families are changing, say, 60 miles an hour or whatever. We're just putting these numbers on
right,
them, of course. But then you got unions, trade unions. Well, 30 miles an hour, maybe.
Well, and except for Andy Stern, maybe.
Well, let's see.
Yeah, when I read your section on labor, you didn't actually go into the divisions in labor.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I can gather, Andy Stern would agree with you and would say, you know, we've got to try to globalize. We've got to try to find new ways of thinking, new ways of approaching. And as you say, the jury's out.
Take on new functions.
That's right.
Then we come to our friends, the government, and 25 miles an hour, if it's lucky. The rates of change. Here's telecom, one of the fastest changing technologies in history, comes along over the last few decades, but it takes Congress 62 years to change the basic telecom act under which all of our telecom operates. It takes finance, which is changing extremely rapidly. It takes Congress and the White House to 60 years to change the Glass-Steagall Act. Which is, again, the framework that they have operated under. And then You know, then you come finally to a car coming down the highway, and it's got steam coming out of its engine, and it's got flat tires in the back, and it's weaving back and forth.
And there's 20 kids in the back seat.
And there's 20 kids in the back, and it's called the education system, and if we're lucky if it's changing 10 miles an hour. And the fundamental question then of this desynchronization, how can an economy that is changing at 100 miles an hour put up with an education system that's changing 10 miles an hour? Now, education isn't just about economics and making a living, but let's face it, guys, you can't have the same industrial style education, everybody showing up on time, working essentially like assembly line workers, and have that interface appropriately with an economy in which that's no longer the central project.
Right. And as you point out, all these things are related. So
everything.
You've got how education is dominated by unions,
yeah.
Which are moving at a different speed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
yeah,
all these
that
things.
Union isn't moving at all, as
that's
far
right.
as we can tell.
That's right.
So
education and then?
Well, then you're getting down to zero change. You know?
Yeah,
and
your last
a lot
three,
of that.
Your last three are moving at,
right.
at almost no speed. That's global governance.
Right.
Political structures. So and it's interesting you say political structures, you separate that from government.
Yeah.
And I understand that.
I
understand that.
Yeah.
In other words, government is the policies and the institutions. What you're talking about is the electoral college, for instance, right?
Yeah.
And the two-party system
yeah,
and
that,
the way that we
well,
do
all of that's gonna
is
have
even
to,
slower than the government.
All of that's going to have to change.
Yeah. Let me ask you very quickly on that one. It looks to me like public financing would actually be a thing that could move political structures.
Oh,
would increase the speed because they wouldn't be locked into this doing the bidding of their high donors, and they'd be able to be more nimble.
I'm inclined to say yes to that. I don't know the downsides.
Right.
I don't know the downsides because if that is the dominant form of political funding, then those who hold the spigot can have an even greater.
Perhaps, yes. And obviously we've found that whatever changes they come up with, people find a way around.
Yeah.
And we just haven't seen that one on a big enough scale to see that. Just to finish this, the desynchronized speed of things in society, you finally say the slowest moving is the legal system.
Oh.
That the law just is not set up to change
well,
fast.
Well, the law, you want some stability in society. You want laws to be there for a reasonable length of time. But the system is very, very slow.
Okay. Now, by the way, just two
other facts.
Oh.
It takes 10 years to okay the building of a runway at an airport. It takes 7 years to add a piece of highway.
And you're saying these are legal questions.
These are legal hoops you have to go through. Legal, permitting, corruption, all kinds of reasons. But the fact is, how do you live in a fast-paced world that's getting faster and faster with all of these desynchronized functions?
I know. One thing L.A. is facing is that we have moved very slowly in increasing our runway capacity to handle the new, I think it's the M80, mm-hmm. the new jet. Mm-hmm. San Francisco is ahead of us. Now, that little fact that they got their development happening quicker means they may handle more of the flights from China, from
right.
India, from Japan, from Taiwan,
right,
from
more
Korea.
Of the business as well.
And it could change in a radical way
yeah.
the way these two cities interact. And no one, I think, had their eye on that ball while it was happening. Let's go to an idea that came up in the discussion of NGOs. I mean, I'm saying underneath, in the discussion of families, is the things we do that don't count in the money economy. And this, to me,
okay.
is one of the biggest ideas
that
in Revolutionary Wealth.
That is one
wealth.
Of the central ideas of Revolutionary Wealth, our book. And that is that there is a hidden economy that economists just measure essentially monetary transactions. And if something doesn't involve monetary transactions, it doesn't show up on their radar. And so their idea is that the economy is a money economy, period. We argue, as have others, and I want to take my hat off to some of them right now because they were there very early on. One of them was Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and another one, my friend Hazel Henderson, whom many of your listeners are well aware of.
She's been on the show more than once. Yeah.
And Hazel has written about this also. But another one is Edgar Kahn. And his book, Time Dollars.
He's also been on the show. Yep.
Okay. Well, these
I'm looking for him.
I don't agree with everything Hazel
yeah.
says or what he
right.
says, but you don't have to agree with what I say. But nevertheless, we all agree that the economists are missing a big chunk of what's really going on. And what's really going on is the creation of economic value in outside the money economy. There, think of it this way. There's a money economy, and right next to it, unmeasured, by and large, and unnoticed, is a non-money economy, which also creates economic value. And what we point out in this book, which I don't think anybody yet has done, is that the connections between these two. You can't analyze the money economy in terms of what we call grossly distorted product, GDP, or the standard measures. You can't understand what's going on unless you take into account the free lunch that is being transferred from ordinary people, whether they're doing volunteer work or whether they're doing unpaid or putting in all kinds of unpaid effort in their homes and in their communities, and changing the so-called real economy of, in which money occurs. For example, stop and think. Anybody listening to this not use an ATM? Well, I don't.
Oh, you don't?
Okay. I don't.
I do,
but
only.
But many people obviously do. What's the consequence of doing that? Well, it's very efficient for certain things. But what you're really doing is you used to go to the bank and there was a teller behind the counter and you gave that teller your information and they punched it in and they manipulated it, and then they gave you they cashed your check or whatever. Now you do that work. You go up to the machine and you do that work. What you have is a third job. We talk about a third job. First job, you got a job, you get paid, and that's your so-called first job. Second job is you work at home. You clean up, you feed the child, you do this, you do that, everything around the house. You're doing that. You're not getting paid to do that.
And that's always been there.
And that's always been there. So that's your second job. The third job is the job you're doing because business is externalizing labor cost.
Right. And one of the things that I think we see with every, and I think what you pointed out that I hadn't seen before, was that with the technology, with online airline ticket purchases, online book purchases, online this, online that, we are actually willing, because of the convenience, the accessibility, the 24/7 nature of it, to take on what used to be someone else's job.
Right. And we calculated, and the numbers are probably rough, that probably 200,000 tellers did the work that we now do by punching in our ATM.
And travel agents.
Travel agents, supermarkets, check yourself out, and so forth. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that this is bad, because we don't want to stop we don't want to lose the utility of new technologies. They are terrific, and we ought to have them, and we want to get more and better, useful technologies. But we also have to understand the consequences, and we have to understand those consequences before we make all those decisions. So, we argue that there is the non-money, all of this is non-money contributions to the money economy. And there are many ways in which we use the term prosumer, P-R-O meaning production, sumer meaning consumer, where production and consumption are fused into one. And we do that ourselves.
Well, in a way, when you pointed out 1, 2, 3 in terms of jobs, it's again 1, 2, 3 in terms of roles, right? We have the producer role, the consumer role,
and
the prosumer role.
Exactly. So what you do, the prosumers do unpaid work. All of us are prosuming when we're doing unpaid work. We buy technology from the marketplace for money, but we use that to do things ourselves. For example, you can have you buy a washing machine. Okay, that means that you do not buy labor from a laundry. Okay, you are now your own home laundry. And by the way, the economists, when you buy that machine, call it. The economists call it consumption. In fact, it's an investment in the creation of economic value.
Okay, we've only got, believe it or not, about a minute.
Okay.
Now, once people get this book and they begin to see the things that have been going unnoticed and that we're missing, what is it you, in a minute here, what is it you hope that people will begin to see, and what will this book offer them?
I think it should help people see the position they play in what is a really historic transformation. That it's not just you, it's not just me. Something is going on out here that's huge, that's changing human life on the planet. And things that are happening to us in our personal daily lives, which seem unconnected with reality, are in fact part of some massive processes that we can play a role in, perhaps, at least understanding it better. We can do better for ourselves. We can understand the diversity of family structure and not go crazy if somebody suggests
another. What's interesting, and we got to pull in part one, you said that's what people got when they read Future Shock,
right.
Was they said, it's not just me. And again, you're telling them it's not just you.
It's not just you.
And as you can see, we've done two parts, and we could do two more. The book is Revolutionary Wealth, How It Will Be Created, How It Will Change Our Lives. The website is www.alvintoffler.net. And you can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly either at my website or at iTunes. My website's terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, whichever one's easier for you to remember. You can also sign up at my website or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com to have an announcement every week emailed to you that tells you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about in two or three articles about the issues. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and you, my listeners. I'll be with you again next week.
This is Tara Devlin, a.k.a. Pterodactyl from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. And this is my two-minute tirade.
Humans evolved not as rugged individuals, but as interdependent beings. From couples to communities to civilizations. In small groups, we survived, but together we thrived. The goddess of the market, the sociopath Ayn Rand, may see selfishness as the highest value, but the goddess of nature asserts we're in this together. So we organize ourselves into governments, supposedly for the benefit of all. For centuries, democracy was a dirty word, but thanks to the liberal age of enlightenment and subsequent revolutions, including our own, democracy is at least publicly embraced as the ideal form of government. Even conservatives have to pretend they're all for it. But conservatism is the ideology of the moneyed elite, with policies designed to seize government for the few and bring the working class masses under heel. Unfortunately, thanks to the right-wing assault on education and the proliferation of propaganda, Americans are ignorant of history and take democracy for granted. Some even think democracy is synonymous with capitalism, when in fact, without regulation, capitalism is an instrument of oppression. So here we are in the midst of a representative democracy under siege by anti-democratic conservatives in both parties, and they're winning. Organized money have captured government and turned it once again into an appendage of their affairs. The conservative supposed disdain for government is just another one of their deceptions. They like government just fine, as long as they can rig it for the rich. Let's make it known. When conservatives complain about government, they're not complaining about government at all. What they're really complaining about is democracy. This is Tara Devlin from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. Go there and find links to my Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram communities, and keep listening for two-minute tirades and more on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. We stick together, we win.
These are hard times for debt collectors. After all, who can pay their bills these days? Not Wall Street, Detroit, millions of homeowners, the rising number of jobless folks, not even several states and cities. But wait, here are some lively prospects for debt collectors. The dead. Yes, there's a boom in dunning the deceased. We're not talking about collecting from big-time debtors who still owe several hundred thousand dollars on their yacht. No, these are workaday people who died while still owing maybe a couple of $100 on their bank credit card, health insurance, or utility payment. It's not possible, of course, to squeeze money out of a corpse, so the target becomes the bereaved next of kin. Hello, I'm very sorry for your loss, but there's this $211.36 balance on your mother's Visa, and we wondered who would be covering this. By the way, there is no legal requirement whatsoever that the debt of those who've passed on must be paid by relatives out of their own pockets. Thus, what the industry calls deceased collections requires a delicate dance to cajole money out of the family without actually demanding it. The industry actually rationalizes its work as a service to those who have departed. As one insider asserts, we want the dead to rest easy, knowing their obligations are taken care of. How benevolent. The actual work is done by a corps of specially trained agents working from cubicles in companies that specialize in this rather macabre fishing for cash. The job is so distasteful that about half of those hired quit within 3 months. Those who stick it out get such on-the-job stress relievers as yoga sessions, foosball games, free snacks, and neck massages. This is Jim Hightower saying, they tell us that we can't escape death and taxes, but it appears that one more thing we can't escape are debt collectors.
I'm Welton Gaddy. On the next State of Belief Radio, a reason rally in the nation's capital. This weekend, engaging people of no faith in the political process. I'll talk with Secular Coalition Executive Director Larry Decker. Also, important work is happening at Auburn Theological Seminary around faith, self-care, and gender issues. I'll visit with Lisa Anderson, founding director of the Sojourner Truth Leadership Circle. And is the fervor of Bernie Sanders supporters a sign of a new secular sacred? Peter Larman addressed that question in a recent article, and we'll explore his thoughts when he joins us on the program. Be sure to visit us at stateofbelief.com and be sure to tune in for Religion and Radio Done Differently. Saturday morning at 10, Sunday morning at 11 Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network.